Hi everyone, Mo here, and welcome to the More Simple Podcast. October is here, and this month we're turning our attention to something deeply important: mental health and prostate cancer awareness. It's a topic that doesn't always get the attention it deserves, but it affects more men and more families than we often realize. So throughout this month, we're creating space for honest, hopeful conversations about men's health. I'll be joined by four incredible guests, two men who have worked through a prostate cancer diagnosis and are now using their stories to help others feel less alone, and two medical professionals who share practical insights on prevention, early detection, and caring for our health as men, brothers, husbands, and fathers. These stories are powerful, eye-opening, and filled with hope. So if there's a man in your life that you love, I encourage you to share this series with him, because awareness truly saves lives. So let's have this conversation together. Now enjoy the show. Alright everyone, welcome back to the More Simple Podcast. This is your host Mo. For those who are just joining us for the first time, welcome. And to our regular listeners, welcome back. Today's episode is one that I cannot wait to share with you, because I think that there's so many things we can tease out of this guest story. And it's also part of our Father's Day special on the More Simple Podcast, where we try to create stories that, you know, speak to just a space where we can explore identity and, you know, connection and just all of the resilience and stories that shape us. Today, I'm honored to sit down with a man whose journey through adversity, cancer, grief, faith, and healing reminds us of what it truly means to live with intention. He was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2013, and he's since turned his pain into purpose. He became a passionate patient advocate and mentor in the survivorship community, serving as a co-facilitator of the Michigan Institute of Urology Prostate Cancer Support Group and partnering with national organizations like the American Cancer Society, Zero Prostate Cancer, NRG Oncology, and the Department of Defense Prostate Cancer Research Program. He also sits on the advisory board of the Michigan Medicine Rogel Cancer Center and has consulted with Lantheus and Merck, all while remaining deeply committed to representing the patient voice. His story doesn't stop at cancer survivorship. He's also endured one of life's greatest heartbreaks, the loss of a child, and yet through it all, he's held onto his faith, his chosen kindness, and continues to ask and answer the question, what is my purpose on this earth? In this Father's Day conversation, we talk about what it means to rebuild after loss, to lead with vulnerability, and to be a father in the fullest and the most tender sense of the word. His journey, I think, challenges stereotypes of masculinity and opens a space for reflection, grace, and healing. Please, everyone, join me in welcoming Mr. Mark Harris, the podcast. Hello.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. It's a blessing just to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I'm so thankful that our path crossed. And many thanks to my collaborator and colleague, Dr. Adam Alexander, for facilitating the connection. And I think we also have to give credit to Dr. Joanne at the OU Cancer Center as well for making all of this happen through Adam. So thank you so much, Mr. Harris.
No, it's a blessing. Joan is Joan Walker. She's a big fan, so that's a blessing.
yes. Yeah, we love Joan. All right, let's just start at the beginning. Can you paint a picture of your childhood for us, and what was your upbringing like?
Oh yeah, I'm the oldest of five, and my dad was the coach. And he was a teacher as well. He was a civics teacher, and he was a coach of basketball and football at the high school where where we live, at Inkster High. So, and dad's thing was exercise was just part of our. So I had to do 5 or 10 push-ups, 5 or 10 sit-ups. When I was, again, I was about 4 years old, three, 4 years old, five,
four
or 10.
Years old.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Then I had to do my chores, make the bed, sweep the room, those kind of things, wash the dishes, 5 or 10 sit-ups, 5 or 10 push-ups, run around the backyard. Then I could go play. So I didn't know that exercise wasn't a part of everybody else's life, but that's how he brought us up though. So, both of my parents were teachers. And then I'm the oldest of five, three brothers and two sisters. So it was, a lot of, as you will know, education.
Yeah.
And so it was a big part of my life. But also, my parents were my dad was very low key, but he was a man's man back in those days, very quiet and things. And my mother was, just very supportive. So when my mother was the first African-American teacher over at a school called Robeshaw, for the full time. But then when I was born, my dad asked my mother to stay home. And that's what a lot of times women did in those days in the 50s or mid-50s. So, yeah, but just a beautiful, just very supportive. My dad died in 1968. He was 45. I was 12.
Wow.
Yeah. And I remember my mother, at the day of the memorial, my mother set me down again. I'm 12 years old. My mother said, "You're going to hear that you're the man of the house. You're not the man of the house. You're 12 years old. So you're the oldest, but I want you to do this and that other, but you're not the man of the house." And it was very important because my mother, you hear that. But for 12 years old, I still was allowed to be a boy, be a child. So, yeah, it is. Yeah. And my mother was very, very wise.
Wow. Is your mom still with us?
Yes. 95 years old. Yep, 95 years old. Yep, November 1st, Lord's will, she'd be 96. But yeah, she still lives by herself. My brother lived next door, but she still lives by herself. Yeah, doing very well.
Sorry to hear about your dad. He died so young.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He did. But, it's just, it is what it is. You learn. And actually, I was a big, so coming back from my father's, we just left the burial ground. And my brother, who's, I was 12, he was 9. So my brother sees a, we're on the way home, and my brother sees a. It wasn't this commercial, but it's something like this: "Things go better with Coke." And my brother got really upset. Going, "Okay, Dad is dead. Okay. How can things go better with Coke? What are we talking about here?" But that's when we realized life goes on. Life goes on because we thought this great man, our father. Of course, everybody feels that way probably about their father. But this great man has died, gone. And the world needs to stop. But things go better with Coke. What? That's what we learned. Yeah, life goes on.
Thanks for sharing that. And you grew up in Michigan, right?
I did. Inkster, it was called Inkster, Michigan at first. It was it's Annapolis Park is where we grew up. And we actually have a historical plaque there. We're the first middle class black neighborhood in the U.S., these two brothers, they created, I think, 368 homes. Specifically for black people. This is, again, 1952, 53, something around there. Mm-hmm. And so when they made the homes, there was no mortgage. There was no places that we could get, black people could get mortgages. So they actually made their own mortgage place. So they actually did a lot.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah, so my mother has been there since 1955, and several of a neighbor across the street, he's been there since 1954. So all these years. So that's 60, 70 years. My goodness.
Wow. That's amazing. Wow.
That's amazing. Wow. But beautiful. We lived in a beautiful, that saying, it takes a village to raise
a child.
Raise a family. Yeah, a child, mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what we had. We had that.
Do you find that still hold true to today?
Not as much. Not as much because we don't connect. We don't connect. When I moved to where I am now, I'm in Ypsilanti. And when I first came here in 2019, people just went past each other. I mean, and we do that or not. Back when we were younger, you said hi. Like, for instance, the first day I went to school in Eastern in 1974, my first day of class, everybody I passed, everybody said hi, mm-hmm. It was just mm-hmm. a beautiful, and I've kept that up, But now, and so I, I was driving first, I think first or second day I was here, driving down the street, and, you know, I'm going down this, and people were walking, and I'm thinking, they're not even looking at the car. So, but now I have people, you know, wave, hey, Mark, you know, so I just, because that, I think people connect that way, you know, you truly become neighbors again and friends and blah, blah, blah. So that's very important.
Yeah, very important. What thing changed in the whole fabric, you know, because I hear a lot about how, you know, way back in the 60s and 70s, you know, you could just, you know, kids could just walk to school.
Absolutely.
What thing really changed the fabric of, you know that social cohesiveness? Because coming from Nigeria, it was so different going back home. Like, coming here was a huge cultural shift for me.
Absolutely.
You have neighbors, you don't talk to yourself. And the irony is that back home we have, you know, fences and tall, you know, barbed wires to keep the thieves away, but the doors were always open to people. But here we don't really have a lot of those tall windows and fences, but we still don't connect with our neighbors. What thing changed in the fabric of America?
That's a very good question. Okay. I think my guess is I think we just became more selfish. I think we became more selfish side, and I don't know why. I don't know. It's more of a me, I kind of thing. I don't know why, because I didn't change. I mean, my children would say, because I speak to almost everybody I pass, and then my children would say, "Well, Dad, do you know them? Do you know them?" I said, "No, but that doesn't mean that I can't talk to them, you know." So I don't know. I don't know. It's unfortunate to me, but I don't know.
All right. I think we would never know, but we can definitely see the change, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, losing your dad at 12 must have been quite a huge shift in your life, right? But you also talked about how a great man he was. How did your relationship with your own father, or even father figures that you probably adopted along the way, influence the kind of father and the man you became?
Well, my dad was definitely my neighborhood, but you know, Dad just instilled you know, a quiet sense of strength, strength. You know, he was always very, very kind, even to the children, even when disciplined and things. I've always been taken by how my dad could discipline him, because he was a coach and thing, teacher, but the kindness was still there, you know, because sometimes as a parent, as a person of authority, you could discipline, but I don't know what you call it, but the kindness is not there, you know, but you have to have, but my dad was always very, very kind, and no matter what he did, you know, just very level-headed. In fact, my dad was very stable. So one time, when I was young, he was sharpening a lawnmower, the push blade.
Yeah.
And he cut himself, and my dad said, "Ouch!" And my mother came running at 100 miles an hour out the back room, and I, you know, I said, "Mother, why did you come running out?" She said, "Because your dad said ouch."
Oh, that is so sweet.
No, but that's just, you know, Dad was, you know, he just accepted, you know, he just went along with things. So she knew that if he says ouch, something is wrong. And sure enough, he had cut himself down to the bone, basically, but cut his hand. But yeah, Dad was just a, and that has very, Dad. And so when Dad died, my mother took a lot of his characteristics and things, because my mother learned to be very, very calm and very, She wasn't my dad, but she was. Yeah. She added a powerful strength to her as well.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that. In fact, she told me, you know, my dad was from down south. She was from Tennessee, Jackson, Tennessee, and she said my mother was from Ipsy, Michigan, up north. And my dad, you know, he would have the southern etiquette and, you know, things. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. Those kind of not that my mother, but my dad was a gentleman. He learned these kind of manners. Good. He had good manners. And she said, my mother said, she told me this about 30 years ago, way after my dad died. She said, you know, I would watch your dad work with you all. And I would I'd be taking notes and things. I didn't tell him. Well, you know how you women are sometimes.
yeah.
But yeah.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, and can you just walk us quickly through your educational path?
Yeah, I went through the Inkster schools, and again, because my parents were teachers, I was a good student anyway, but especially because my parents were teachers, you know, because you didn't want word to get back to your parents, you know. So then I went to Eastern, and I'm going to be truthful. At Eastern, the first semester, I started skipping. And it was like a drug because I had never skipped before, and my parents didn't know. So, you know, by then my dad was dead. So my mother. But I got a B average or something. I forgot what it was, and it was kind of the worst thing that I could have done because it was. So now I'm skipping more and more, and actually I eventually got kicked out of Eastern. I got kicked out of Eastern academic probation. And so I guess people would think that was just a waste of time, waste of money. But during that time, you know, I became the because in high school I was very, very quiet, very shy, you know, didn't talk to anybody, blah blah blah, just very uncomfortable.
As a firstborn, that's very rare.
Yeah. Oh, in the house. But outside,
it was,
you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Because you got the cool kids, you got the guys that are, you know, girl magnets and everything. You wish you'd be that. I wasn't that way. I was just quiet and things. So when I got to Eastern, you know, that changed. In fact, when I went back to my 20th high school anniversary, and somebody said, "Is that Mark talking?" They couldn't believe I told them, "Oh yeah, he's making up for not talking back in." So, but yeah, but then I went to school. Then I was going to go, but then when my son was born, so I went to work. So I went to my next thing was I got certified as a personal trainer, which I did quite a bit of that, and then. I went back to school in 2020. You know, I was 60 something. I forgot what. Yeah, 63 years old. And so I talked to a guy who I trained. I think we've been together like 15 years. Personal training. So 15 years, I told him I was going back to school. He said, "What for?" I said, "No, not to improve my job or anything. Just because I just want to finish, you know, by the grace of God, I've been able to do, you know, I was a designer for engineering. The designers are the guys who draw the drawings for the engineers and things. So I was that. So it's not like I didn't work. In fields where education was, because I just kind of learned on my own. So, that's my story.
Thanks for sharing that. I could not have pegged you for someone skipping school because you're so.
yeah. Well, not, you know what? To your point.
Yeah.
So I found out that, so I looked at my transcript because I wanted to know again in 2019, I wanted to get back in school because I just wanted to finish the degree. Cause I'm only like 20 credits away from a bachelor's.
Yeah,
which is not that much, you know, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I I went back, and a friend of mine works in records. And so I said, Ramon, I want to see if I can get what I have to do to get back in school. By the time I left there, about 45 minutes later, I was back in school. I said, Ramon, I just wanted to see, but she had gotten me back in school. On my records, I found out that I had taken bowling my first class, my first semester. It was at 8 o'clock. And that was a class I skipped, so I failed that class. I didn't know you could drop classes. So I failed that class. So when I told my wife I'm going back to school, she said, "What makes you think you can pass bowling now?" I said, we both laughed and everything. But I took statistics class and got an A out of it. But, you know, but it was just, and it was great going back to school because here I am. It was like the Disney movies. I'm with these young people. I'm this old guy, and so I have all this experience, I have all this wisdom. And so when a teacher asked a question and nobody raised their hand, the young people, and I'm thinking, wow, I remember those days, I'm thinking, you know, because first of all, there's a girl in the back that you don't want to look stupid with, or you don't want to show that you're not intelligent, you know. But then I realized, of course, at 63, I'm in school to learn. So if I raise my hand, I have the wrong answer, the teacher's going to tell me to write that answer. That's how I learn.
Oh, yeah.
See the pressures of
peer
the
pressure.
Social... peer pressure,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Peer pressures, you know, you don't have that. At least I didn't have it because I didn't care less. The main thing was the main thing, getting the knowledge of the class. So, again, I took a statistics class, got an A, so it's all good.
thanks for sharing that. Let's fast forward, you know, a little bit forward in time, and to talk about your cancer diagnosis, right?
Yep.
In 2013, you were diagnosed with prostate cancer, a life-altering moment. Can you take us back to that time? What went through your mind when you got the news and all?
Yeah, well, I got to go back a little bit to 2011. 2011, so I get a yearly checkup. 2011, my PSA, prostate specific antigen, it was 5.3.
Wow.
Now, at that time, they wanted between 0 and 4. So it's 5.3. So the physician said, listen, if you rode your bike within the last week, or if you had sexual intercourse, that could drive your PSA up. So come back in a week. Well, he said, abstain from those things and come back in a week. Well, I forgot in 2011. I forgot. So in 2013, I needed some medicine. I needed a refill of medicine. And he said, I'm not going to give the refill until we have another physical exam. So I go there. And my wife would tell you, you know, Mark wasn't happy about it. And I was not. So, again, one of the things was the PSA, and now it's 13.2. So it went up
from 5 to 13 in 2 years.
2 years, yes, 2 years. And as you know, the you look at the doubling rate, so
yes,
5
yeah,
to 10. Yeah. So now you got to do something. But now, you know, I have my attention. I'm focused on, okay, it's 13. I have a friend, Dr. Brown, who... And I know she liked lentil soup, so I took her out to lunch. We had some lentil soup, and then we went over my thing, and went over my report. And so she said, "Mark, you know, you have to do something." And so I followed up. Then I eventually had a biopsy. It's Thursday, October the 3rd, it's about 8 o'clock. I just started watching the 8 o'clock movie. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Solomon calls, you know, I speak to Mark, you know, Dr. Solomon, your biopsy came back positive for prostate cancer. You have prostate cancer. But he said, but I'm going to do everything that I can to help you. And I said, thank you. And it's interesting because now I realize my parents had drilled into us, look at the bright side. Always look at the bright side. No matter what, look at the bright side. So, and now I'm on automatic because as soon as you hear that you have cancer, you're just on automatic. But I automatic, now that I revisit, I go back and and look at that moment, I realized even then I looked at the bright side. I didn't focus on the cancer. I focused on that he said he was going to help me during this journey.
But that was your bright side.
That was my bright side. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. And so after we hung up, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, man, you know, because you just feel alone because people don't talk about cancer. People don't talk about cancer. So, and I thought about not telling my wife. I did because as a man, I see my role as being the protector.
Yes.
You know, not the reason that there is anxiety, that there is, you know. So that was, but I got over that. I thought about that for about probably a minute or so. Again, I don't know what time, but I called out and said, biopsy came back positive for prostate cancer. My wife comes running in and she says, well, what are we going to do? This was a Thursday. Mm-hmm. I said, well, he said, Dr. Solomon said, we're going to have a meeting on Monday and we'll talk about the options and where we go from here. My wife said, what are we going to do? I said, I don't know. I realize, this has happened in 2013. I realize now I had taken that cancer news and put it in the back of my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife is trying to ask me about stuff and I'm just, because I don't want to, right now I don't want to deal with it. I compartmentalize for sure. I put it away. So my wife is asking, you know, I said, hey, I don't know. I don't know. I've never been here. So we got to find out. She had one. So what you going to do? And then now again, I'm in the moment. I said, can't you see I'm watching television? So
avoiding.
Yeah. And that was, and so she left and it's amazing because my wife is usually very determined about getting answers, but and when she walked away, and I watched the rest of that movie, and I realized now that movie was just white noise.
It took, of course.
So I didn't have to deal with what the cancer news because I'm just, and I can't tell you what that movie,
what the movie was about.
I have no idea. I can't even tell you what genre. I can't tell you at all. But I know because it went off at 10. So about an hour and a half, it just held space. That's all it did. But then when I went to bed, so in the solitude and the quiet, everything, that's when I'm going to die. That's my natural side. But then my spiritual side, it didn't take long for my spiritual side to say, okay, how are we going to use this to help others? Because God, Dr. Moore, God has always given me, let me experience things so that I can help others. And that's why when people ask, I've been on people, they say, well, are you scared? No, I can honestly say that. Well, first of all, I didn't give because I went to sleep. I thought about that. And what's my spirit? I went to sleep, solid and slept solid as a rock. When I got up the next morning, my first question was, well, who do we tell? Because a lot of people, because a lot of people just go by other people. They don't tell people. Well, I kind of laughed at myself. Hey, you go tell everybody. As much as you talk, you go tell everybody. So, that's what I did. I believe now that one of the reasons is that I didn't hold this news to myself.
You shared it.
I shared it. Yeah, and I shared it in the hope that it would help others. And by the grace of God, I've had two people tell me, two people tell me, Mark, I talk about my cancer because of you.
Wow.
Another young lady, she said sometimes I write stuff on Facebook, and she said, I read your story. I gave it to my husband. And so now he talks to other people about it. So that's why the assignment from the Lord is, okay, this is what you have. You spread the news and help others deal with this.
Yeah. So many things I could unpack from your story. But first, I just want to say kudos to you for taking care of yourself, because you started by saying you always did your yearly checkup.
Yes.
Which is something we don't find very common in a lot of our men, especially, you know, black men. So thank you for pointing to the importance of that. Because if you didn't have that baseline like you did in 2011 when they found your PSA being a value of 5, and then the jump it went to 13 in 2013, how would they have known something was going off with you? So again, thanks for sounding the importance of that alarm. And I'm also thankful for your wife, you know, despite you saying you forgot to, you know, let her know about 2011. I bet she always like, But what a life, what a story.
Yeah, that's very important. I tell, by the grace of God, I'm a co-facilitator for cancer support group. But what I tell my men is, yes, you have the disease, but that woman is right with you. She's in the foxhole with you. She's in fact, a lot of times the women are more concerned about it than you
exactly,
are.
Exactly.
You know? This is a team disease. Cancer team is all about team.
And I imagine that with, you know, because in the work I've done so far with, you know, black men and prostate cancer, it's usually that underlying theme of fear. You know, even though it doesn't, it's not, most of them don't define it as fear, but, you know, the uncertainty, like, what's going to happen to my family now, right? And that fear itself withholds them from sharing a lot about their diagnosis or their treatment. Heck, I had a man in my study who sent his family back home, you know, on a, because they're immigrants here, black immigrants in to the U.S. Sent them on vacation and went for his treatment by himself. He drove himself for all the treatment. And by the time he finished everything, he, you know, sent them back, you know, and then he finally told his wife, and he said his wife was so pissed off at him. Absolutely. And so I go, if you could do this again, what would you do differently? He said, for sure, tell my wife, you know.
Absolutely.
But in that moment, it made sense for him, because he said he didn't want to worry them, you know. And I didn't think he did it out of selfishness. As a matter of fact, I thought he did it out of concern for them, right?
Absolutely. And that's, and again, that's what I... But yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the other hand, I have a friend, and I've had more than this one year. But this example, she retired in 2006, I think it was, in June. Her husband goes to his doctor's appointment. She says, "Well, I'm gonna go with you." He says, "Well, I don't want you to go. I don't want you to go." Mm-hmm. This is in July. In July, they go to the doctor appointment. She finds out her husband has cancer and is diabetic. Now he hasn't told her anything. She's not changed, and he died that December.
Oh no!
Yeah. See, the thing is, this is why I tell men, okay, you, it's just unfair for your wife to know. Because you may take, you know, you may not be here. We don't know. We don't know. So you have to. Okay, you want to care. You're saying you're caring for you. And listen, I understand what he did, because again, I had the same thought process. But we if we're caring for our loved ones, let's include them. And I think some of the stress that men have is the hiding. Is the hiding. That's just much more stressful. I think it's much more stressful. And that's my opinion, of course. I'm not saying I got it right.
I mean, no, you're spot on, and I'm so sorry to hear about that, your friend. The wife must have been in a bind. I just want to pedal back a little bit to defining again what PSA means. So for our folks who might be wondering, PSA is the prostate specific antigen, like Mr. Harris said. It's a protein that is made by the prostate gland, and usually a small amount of PSA is normally found in the blood of all men, and it's measured with a blood test, you know, the PSA blood test, so like a finger prick, and they can get that out of you. But higher than normal levels may be a sign of a prostate problem. It could be due to inflammation, enlargement, or even prostate cancer. So like Mr. Harris said, if you ride your bike a lot, if you have just ejaculated or, you know, just had sex, and then if you have an infection, maybe like a inflamed, you know, prostate, like you will see benign prostatic hyper pleasure. That can be indicative of problems. So it's not always, you know, a marker for prostate cancer, but at the very least, you know, they might follow up with a biopsy or a digital rectal examination to know what's going on. But the crux of this conversation is, please get a baseline, do your yearly checkup.
Early detection is the key. With mine, after I had surgery, you know, he said, "Mark, we got it right before, but it was about to get to the bladder, and so it was encapsulated, which means it's inside the prostate. But once it goes to something else, localized, and once it's metastasized, which means outside of the organ that it started, then you're talking a whole new different thing. So let's say it got to the bladder, it's still called prostate because it originated with prostate. It's not bladder cancer. It's still called prostate.
I want us to, I don't want us to lose this conversation without asking you this, Mr. Harris. So, especially for our Black men, right? What do you wish men, more men, you know, especially Black men, knew about prostate cancer? And what advice do you have for those who are walking that journey now?
Number one, there are no symptoms for early prostate cancer. I want to make that clear. I want to make that loud because I know men, I feel good. It's not about, in fact, when my wife went to my first thing, he said, are you getting up early, getting up at night?
Yeah,
she said, no. Are you getting up, is your urine slow? No. I had none of that stuff. And if it wasn't for, in fact, I was blessed because the doctor made me come back in. I was going to skip that year.
And you know, the next year will have probably been like 20 something.
And then it may have sounded like it from what the Dr. Rogers said, it would have got to my bladder. So now again, I would have been in a world of hurt. But yearly, and gentlemen, a lot of you all don't go because of the DRE, digital rectal exam. Well, now they're actually recommending that you, the doctor, physician don't have to do that. And I wish I had a diagram because, this is the rectum. The finger goes in where the prostate is actually, so you're only hitting the back side of it. So that's the thing is, go get it. The PSA is a blood draw. Now, if you go to your physician, let's say you get a yearly check, they're gonna draw your blood anyway and just ask. Now, the PSA is not a standard screen, and I don't know why, but
unfortunately, that's the only one we have now.
And I know you'll see that there's over treatment and blah blah blah. It's the best thing that we have right now.
It's
the best thing. And sometimes I think the overtreatment comes from when a person finds out they have cancer. For instance, so you have 3+3 is
Gleason
six.
Score. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gleason score is six. I think 5-10 years from now, they're not even going to call that prostate cancer. They'll probably call it prostate abnormality or something.
Because
it's the word cancer that freaks people out, freaks the men out, freaks the families out. So 3+3 is and they call it active surveillance. We'll watch it. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, we let the word. So don't let the word freak you out. Again, Dr. Bo said, it doesn't necessarily mean you have cancer. So get a check. You know, just see what's going on. That's it's so important for a gentleman to do this. Go get your yearly checkups. So I've heard this statement so many times, but about 2 years ago, it seemed like the Lord just shined the light on me. You hear that women are more proactive about their health. They go to the doctor more, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And so I thought about this. So what do girls do? They see their mother go get their checkup and thing. They do it.
Mm-hmm.
Boys, are going to see their fathers do what? Not go, not talk about it. They're going to see the same thing. We have to, gentlemen, we have to somehow change how our families do things.
Yeah.
We have to change that routine. Now, if you do something, don't do it in secret. Do something and let your family know. Let your boys know. Especially let your boys know. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. Let's be more conscious about what we're doing, so we can model the behavior that we're trying to get from our children.
Love that. Love that. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I love those two things you talked about. One is, you know, get it done and, you know, take your health seriously. And then also that intergenerational communication. We need to know our family history. As you know, one of the risk factors for prostate cancer is, you know, family history, in addition to being Black and then an age as well. And you find out that in our community, we withhold those information, not because we're trying to be mean or, you know, sinister about it. We just don't share our information.
No.
So you hear things like, my father died. We think it was cancer, but we don't know because, you know, pops never mentioned it. We need to start breaking that cycle of silence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. One other thing is that the people may not know, because of the BRCA 1 and 2 gene, sometimes if a mother has breast cancer, the son
can have
the likelihood of him having prostate cancer is higher. If the father has prostate cancer, the likelihood the daughter is more likely to have breast cancer. So just be aware of those connections.
And there's like Lynch syndromes as well, you know, that can, and I think there's another one that I forget the name, that predisposes, like you talked about, you know, your father having prostate cancer can, you know, increase your own predisposition to breast cancer as a female. So again, family history is really, really great to, like, you
very
know,
important.
To talk about that.
You know, but unfortunately, a lot of our families, we don't know, as you said,
we don't know.
You know, I was in Miami last year, and they were talking about how the genetic testing. So you go get genetic testing, you go home and talk with the family and stuff. And after a while, I said, that sounds good, but in the Black and brown communities, we're not doing that. We're not sitting around talking about what's going on. So a lot of us, we just don't know. It's just, you know, I'm not trying to be mean or nothing, but I just don't know.
And again, genetic testing can also be a way to empower families to take these preventive steps, especially through early screening, lifestyle changes, and even risk reducing strategies. So again, know your values. There's nothing quite as, you know, as safe as knowing your baseline. And then follow that every year. You know your values. So if something is off or deranged, early intervention, it saves your life in so many ways. I can't even, you know, underscore the importance of that.
In fact, I tell men, I ask men, I said, do you know your PSA? Well, I got to check. I said, but do you know the number? Well,
what
my
does it
physician
mean?
No. You need to know. You need to know because if physician tells you something different, so you gotta know.
And thanks. Those are really great gems we dropped for our men, and we can't wait to just highlight that when we release the podcast. Now, before we move into this next section, I want to take a moment to acknowledge the deep sensitivity and courage it takes to talk about personal loss, especially the loss of a child. It's one of the most unimaginable experiences a parent can endure. And yet, those stories of grief also hold powerful truths about love, about our resilience, and I know your faith is also an integral part of your life. You lost your son. Can you share what happened and how you were able to navigate, or you even keep navigating that profound grief?
So it's actually tied into so I was diagnosed with cancer again, October 3rd, 6 days later, Michael's diagnosed with, October 3rd. See, in October the 5th, I get a text from my daughter saying Michael's about to have surgery. So my daughter's in Arizona. My son is in the same city I am. I think it's surgery. Mm-hmm. My son and I, we didn't have a lot of communication. So I go up to the hospital. I say, it's a Sunday. Michael, what's up? And he said, I got a lot of pain below my ear. And when he said that, he pointed. I had to go around to the side of the bed and look. And I may have saw a pimple. I didn't see anything, see anything. So they biopsied him that day. It was a biopsy. And then that Wednesday, so 6 days later after I was diagnosed, he was diagnosed with a different cancer, adenocarcinoma of the parotid gland. He had cancer of the saliva gland. So, so it's interesting. The Lord was with us because I got diagnosed first. And so my son had to listen to me because my son was a know-it-all. At 30 years old, he has all the world problems solved and everything.
I just like his father. Apple tree, apple.
Wait a minute. Wait, what are you saying?
They fall too far.
So I got it and got the news and I picked him up and I had him listen to this song by Tim McGraw. Live Like You Were Dying. So it's a very good song. Live Like You Were Dying. In fact, the song he talks about, the beginning of the song, he talks about a cancer diagnosis. So that you receive a cancer diagnosis, and he said he lived like you're dying. So, and I think that song is so appropriate. But for everybody, one of my coworkers would say, as soon as you're born, you're going to die. So thing is. What I tell my men, what I told Michael, I said, Michael, really nothing has changed. Because we have a cancer diagnosis, we were going to die sooner or later. That's all men do. So really, I think that's what I try to do. I try to normalize things, that this. So we're just more conscious of our mortality, whereas other people, they think you're guaranteed a longevity, and you don't. We may live longer than some other people. So anyway, I really told him. I we talked about it, and then I had him listen to us. We listened to that song together, and so it was we were at one hospital. We were there for 2 weeks, and his was growing. After about 2 weeks, he had a tumor on the side of his face. It grew so fast, and you could see Michael one day. You would see Michael, and the next day you would say, "Wow, that's new growth." It was growing that fast, so we got transferred over to U of M. And Dr. Matthew Spector, God always gives you what you need. Mm-hmm. So we had Dr. Matthew Spector. He was 33. Michael was 30. And so he examined Michael and he said, "I'll see you in 2 weeks." I said, "Doctor, 2 weeks is going to be too long, So when he said, "I'll see you next week," when he came, he said, "Wow, you were right, So that was late October. So the surgery was on November 12th. And, we were kind of anxious because, why we got 3 weeks before surgery.
Right.
But then you realize that there's people. So the statistic that the American Cancer Society, there's 5,500 people a day being diagnosed with cancer.
Diagnosed cancer,
5,500. And so also there's another statistic. One out of every two men and one out of every three women in their lifetime would be diagnosed with cancer of some sort. So there's a lot of people with cancer. We found out that they moved two people out of November. They were scheduled for November 12th. They moved two people because Michael's surgery was all day long. And so, my ex-wife was really upset. How come we got to wait so long? I said, really? I said, listen, they moved two people. So imagine... Yeah, imagine they came to you and said, "Dr. Mo, your child's cancer is not as bad as this man, so we're going to move yours out. You're not taking that."
No,
I said, "This is the world we're in now because in cancer. You just don't realize how many people. In fact, that's why so many hospitals and universities think." they have their own center. There's a building, but it's just cancer. It just is that many. You know, you have MD Anderson. You have all these people that are just nothing but cancer. So, you know, so you're trying to. So Michael and I, we're going to appointments. And again, because I had prostate cancer, I was able to just focus on him. Prostate cancer, by the grace of God, mine was slow. It usually is slow. So I could go to my appointments, but, you know, I just focused on him. And we had the surgery. And it's interesting, Pharrell's song, Happy, was
Happy,
out.
Happy, yeah. Oh.
Yeah. And usually I would have really enjoyed that song. But, you know, because of what was going on. So, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm not going to, not so much thinking, I wasn't going to give in to this, to our situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because one thing is, again, because the Lord had blessed us that I was first. And so when Michael was diagnosed, I was able to be kind of, we were kind of a journey. We were travelers on this road together. And so that was a blessing. That was a blessing. And then again, I'm trying to model again the behavior. So we're not going to give in to what could be. We're staying in the moment. We're alive now. We'll do the very best way we can. So, so we get to November 12th. He has surgery because now it's out here and it is consumed part of his ear. We have surgery. They cut the tumor off. They cut his ear off. U of M had asked, could they have the tumor, because it was the second, either the first or second case at U of M like that.
Yeah.
So he, you know, signed off the waiver and stuff. And so when I went downstairs, they rolled him in at 7:30. They rolled him out at 7:30 in the morning. They were done at 7:30 at night.
So, wow, 12 hours.
12 hours. 12 hours. Yes. And so, and my Michael's
and
mother.
And had the cancer spread? That's, what stage was it?
Not at that time.
Okay.
So my Michael's mother had made a friend with a lady, Caucasian, and they were, you know, because they both were, both their sons were in there a long time, and so that's when I found out you have a consultation after you tell us, you know, what happened with the surgery. So the other mother went to her consultation and came out crying, and I'm gonna tell you, I did not think anything about it. I really didn't. And so Michael's mother came over and said, my ex came over and said, you know, when they went in there, it was more cancer than they thought. They couldn't get it all. And so, but again, even that didn't register. That didn't register because the whole family thing was November 12th is we'll get rid of the cancer. So that was just all in my mind. So we go in there and Dr. Spector comes out and he starts out with, we think, which I didn't hear the we think. I did not hear the we think. We got all the cancer. All I heard was we got all the cancer. Somehow, I don't know what it is, but I didn't hear the we think. I just heard we got all the cancer, you know. But then I do remember him adding, but it could be as small as a pinprick. It could be small as a pinprick. So, and that's why I make a big deal now. People say cancer-free.
Remission.
What's the other word there? Cancer-free. And but I said, cure. I really don't like those. I like, and I use it all the time, it's either detectable or non-detectable. So in that case, it was non-detectable.
Detectable, yeah.
Yep. So I go. So I had to wait. That was about 7:30, and I couldn't see Michael until 11. So the rest of the family, it's been a long day. So they went home. I stayed up there. And I'm staying there, and I'm in the waiting room, and I hear this man. I don't know. He's probably in his 50s, 60s, 60s, or 70s. But he's crying like a baby, and he didn't care. Because they opened up his wife and they found cancer, and he's crying because they evidently and I could hear him talking to his brother, and I was thinking, wow, that would be me talking to Paul, my brother, you know, and I was thinking, wow. Then it finally hit me, just because you have surgery doesn't mean all the cancer is gone. In my mindset, that was the day that we'll be done with the cancer. It'd be on our road to recovery. So I go to the nurse. I said, this is the ultimate box of candy, a box of chocolate. You don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
You don't know what you're going to get. So that's when I realized. So I sit down there, and then they say you can go there. And when I went down there, and I saw Michael, and Michael saw me, and Michael, he was in so much pain. It was absolutely mind blowing. It was so much pain, and actually, and I did faint. I fainted. It was a vasovagal. Man, I could feel my blood because with the vasovagal, when you faint, you know, the blood just drops, go down to you. So, and I could feel it coming on. I said, I need help, and then I tried to get to a chair, and then when I came to. And I wasn't gone. I wasn't out alone. But I'm in the same bed as I'm next to my son now, you know. And Michael's kind of freaking out because, you know, when he looks over, oh, Dad is here. You know, I say, okay, Michael, I'm good. I'm good. I just saw you. That made me be unconscious for a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So and then they we sat there and then. You know, so then you're just going up there being supportive, And they had cut his ear off. So Cornell had a program. They were doing a clinical trial. They were printing ears with flesh or something.
3D. Oh, yeah.
3D. Yeah, right. 3D printing.
Yeah.
And so I looked into that because one of the days after. I'm on Michael, so right side is what the ear got cut off. So I'm on Michael's right side and in the hospital, and I was saying something. He said, Dad, I can hear you. I can hear you from my right.
Wow.
So we're saying, wow, that's so we were very excited about that. So I started looking up for Cornell, but of course we didn't go all the way through. So he was doing much better. He went home. Life was, you know, we're thinking life was good. The saying ignorance is bliss for us, for our family, that was us. So we're thinking things are going up, blah, blah, blah. But on December 18th, Michael calls me and says he has about a dollar size, numbness on his chest, and it just numb. No. Okay, so we said, all right, no, well, let's go. And so I didn't take him to U of M. I took him to Ipsy, St. Joe in Ipsy at the time of St. Joe, because it's closer. So we're looking, and the doctor leaves, and then when she comes back, and people in our family are just very good at reading body language, and when she came in, she didn't have to say anything, but we knew. She says, who's your oncologist? Oh, well, that's not the question that we want to hear. So the next day we go to the doctor. Again, Dr. Matthew Spector, I let him know that, you know, we had to be seen, and I was going, do I need to get the records? No, he took care of everything. He got just a beautiful man. Just very kind. So he got the records and everything. So we go up there, and it had to, in fact, I still have the records, but it had metastasized to his liver, his lung, his iliac crest, several other places, you know. Oh, no. So we had to go in. And I'm going to tell you, when the doctor came in and told him that he had more cancer, the cancer was back and it was through his throughout his torso, even advancing down to his below his waist. Michael, we use humor a lot. Our family use humor a lot.
Oh.
And Michael, I can't remember what it was, but the contrast of getting that news and Michael's attempt at humor was just a very sad thing to see and to hear. Because, you know, I understand because I do the same thing. It keeps me level head. Because I don't go to the fear side.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting, and we came out there, you know, and you know, we were just quiet. We were just quiet. So the this was December 23rd, 2013. So she says, well, we'll start his chemo the day after Christmas.
Yeah.
Again, which is 26th. This is 23rd. I said, no. I mean, do we have to? And again, now I understand because things are booked up.
And the holidays and all that, yeah.
Yes, yes. But as a parent, I just couldn't. I had to do something. Now, if I do something and it doesn't happen, then I'm upset. But then, or you know, it is what it is. But I went out there. I said, "Well, can we get it early?" She said, "Well, you could try." I go out there. I said, "Excuse me, you know, my son just got it's metastasized. By you know, can we get something tomorrow, the 24th, which is again Christmas Eve, 24th." This young lady and I, to this day, I'm sorry that I didn't get her name and didn't get. I did hug her, but I wish I'd have got her name. Because that lady, I don't know her name. She went back and forth. She was at the computer. She went running back somewhere, come back, got her back, running back again, come where. I think she ran three times, come back and said, "Mr. Harris, you're good for tomorrow."
Yeah.
That's just a beautiful thing. That's a beautiful thing. So we go in there, we start the, and when I go into the cancer center, there's so many people. Then I realize, wow, man, there's so many people. So, but then, yeah, so he started there 23rd, but then February the 25th, you know, I get word that, which is a Wednesday, I get word that, that Michael had had a problem. And I didn't think much of it. It was in the morning. I taught my next class, but when I go home, took a shower and then go up to his afternoon and Michael's, you know, he's behind. Oh, so we go to ER and they said, they took us, you go sit in this room here. We go to a little room. They come in. I'm sorry. We go to, yes. So then the doctors come and say, I forgot what they say. In essence, you know, Michael's in really bad shape. And so we go in and he's behind a curtain and go around and, you know, Michael is intubated and things. And so a little doctor comes up and says, he says, people, about 92 or 93% when they're like this, they don't improve from where they are now. What do you want us to do? And I said, you know, because, you know, my wife is, Christine's asking, you know, are they saying they want to pull the plug? I said, you know, I didn't even listen to her because I'm looking at, he's a little Asian guy. I'm looking down at him. I'm thinking, and I said, is he dead yet?
No.
I said, no. I said, then we do everything we can, you know, because, you know, he's the monitor is there. And on that monitor, the last line was was the respirator, but his heart was strong. His everything was strong. I'm just, oh no, so we do everything we can. So they did it, and then at around, so we stayed there, and then Dr. Spector come down. He says, have you seen blah, blah, blah? I said, no. So he, first of all, I said, Dr. Spector, what are you here? Because, you know, I know you're in surgery. You have surgery. But he left his surgery. Again, just a beautiful guy. So he showed me, and then there's three big cancer spots. Again, we knew the torso, but there, on the MRI, there's three big cancer spots in his brain that we didn't know about. So, that day before, Michael slipped and fell. Mm-hmm. This Wednesday, he slipped and fell, and actually, that's how he slipped and fell. So actually, it wasn't the cancer that killed him. He bled out to his brain stem. And that's what killed him, but he had a concussion. So, but again, God was good with us because cancer didn't kill him. It would have been an awful, awful death. That cancer would have been an awful death because it had got his brain.
Yeah.
Because Michael was on, he was on morphine, liquid morphine, tablet morphine, and 2 oxycodone all at the same time. And he was taking it every 2 hours. Every 2 hours. That's at the, in fact, when, right before surgery, Michael had run out. Surgery was at 7. Michael had run out at 2 o'clock. So my son is not going to complain about anything. He's just that way. Yeah, I'm going to complain. So, but you could see in his eyes, his face was normal. You could see the pain in his eyes. And I said to the, we talked about this yesterday, my wife, but she reminded me. I said he's in a lot of pain. Because he ran out of medicine at 2 o'clock. So that means it's almost 7. So he's missed two times that he would have taken medicine. She said, he's going to be rolled in it in 10 minutes. I said, but he's in pain now. He needs something now. And so my wife reminded me yesterday, hey, Mark, you made her cry. I don't care about that. I mean, with all due respect, but my son is in pain. He's in great pain and he's not saying nothing. I need him to be, we need to address this right now. Anyway. So getting back to, Michael's there and I get a call, Thursday morning, slightly after midnight. So it was Wednesday, Thursday morning that Mr. Harris, you know, he had a big crash and, nothing else we can do. I said, you know, you don't have to do anything heroic. But a friend of mine used to work for Gift for Life. I said, if you can make him look as though he's breathing, because his sister and his mother had to come from Phoenix, and they wouldn't get there till the next day. I said, if you can, you know, do what you do and make him. Because a friend from Gift for Life had told me, Mark, we can make the body look like they're alive and stuff. You know, you put them on a machine and the thing go up and down. Your chest goes up and down. Blah blah blah. And sure enough, when they got there at 7:30, he looked good. He looked really, really good, like he was just sleeping, you know. Mm. And I was so glad that. And the young man who left, he left right for 5 minutes before my wife, my ex-wife, and his mother and my daughter got in there, because I wanted to thank him because they saw Michael looking fantastic, to the point that when I had to, called put a plug, you know, they were saying, you know, my ex was saying, no, he trust me, he's gone, he's been gone, you know. So but that's you know, but so that evening, because he was pronounced dead 7:02, February 27th, 2014, pronounced dead. So I go home and you know, Dr. King says, you know, after calmly and honestly, you have to examine yourself at times. You have to look at yourself. And I did that. You know, Mark, every time people ask how things are and, you know, how's, you know, how's things going? You always say fantastic. Well, are they fantastic now? Again, this is about an hour later. I thought about it, and the scripture clearly came to me. 1 Thessalonians 5:18, in everything give thanks. Because this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you in everything. In the King James Version, there's two words. And but in everything. So, but because it's God's will, I just felt better. And I was able to tell my daughter, I said, and everybody else, you know, it says everything give thanks. But if God had given us $1 billion, you know, we would have said, oh, thank you, Jesus. That's us. But here, you know, everything gives thanks. So the next day when I went to class, I had four classes that day. I went to class and nobody could say Mark was wrong because we had a great time. We had a great time. I told the class at the end, because when I got diagnosed, I told them at the beginning of the class, and it sucked the very air out that room. So I told them after, but they were so quiet, they were down. I said, hey, I'm not dead yet. Let's go. But I knew if I told them that Michael had died, there's no way they would have rebound. So, but I did that. The Lord renewed my mind. I went to the next class, and I did that three other times. You know, it was just God is good. God is good.
Well, I mean, what do you say to that? Thanks for just capturing just everything, the grief, earlier in your sharing your story, you talked about how your dad taught you how to see, or your mom and dad taught you how to see the silver lining, like, you know, what is the joy in this? And as we were talking about your son's story, I'm like, how do you make purpose out of all of that pain? But you've said it, you've shared it.
Absolutely.
And thank you for sharing that. It's the pain, the difficulty, but also the purpose you see in everything that, you know, went on in Michael's life. And I pray that God will continue to keep you and your family, as you know, should keep you in all the work they've been doing.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. I appreciate
Thank you. Real quick, before I send you off, because we've spent such a long time talking to you, I don't want to keep you any further. You've been very well involved in advocacy. Work at the American Cancer Society. You work with the Department of Defense, NRG Oncology, Zero Prostate Cancer, at the Michigan Clinics. My goodness, that's a whole lot. And also you serve on the Michigan Advisory Board. Why is advocacy so important to you? And what do you hope men like you, especially black men like you, learn more about what kind of work you do and the impact it has on our community?
Yeah, that's very good. So last November, I was in Washington, and one researcher said, you know, Mark, there's a gulf between the community and the medical field, which I agree. And so what I did, why it's so important, again, I want to be loud. I had a guy tell me that, Mark, you don't look like a punk when you talk about your cancer. And at first, you know, first I said, you know, inside I'm saying, I don't care what you mean. But then I thought about it, and because I know the guy. I know the guy, and I know he's not a negative guy. Then I thought about it. I'm saying, oh, this is why I do this. Because he realized now I didn't lose my masculinity. I didn't lose my who I am. I'm still Mark. And so the fact that he said, you don't look like a punk, was actually a compliment. And that's why I'm very, because again, I'm trying to model behavior. I'm trying to be and the Lord has always put me in a place where I can be, I can show you better than I can tell you. A lot comes from just a story. And the thing is, how I'm doing it, you know, has just been a blessing. So what I want to do is, number one, forget number one, forget a hierarchy. I want to model what it looks like for life after the diagnosis, for life after diagnosis. you know, because I tell people now, in fact, I haven't got my PSA checked this year, but it's over a decade of undetectable cancer. So I want to monitor that thing. And then the second main thing is I have to educate. We need to educate our community. A lot of time, people don't know about the fact. A friend of mine, she had a scare, a cancer scare, and so she was telling some of her friends that she knew very well. She said, "Well, that happened to me. Thing is, we don't talk about it. So I want to be as loud as I can to start a conversation, because sometimes it just needs to, if you see somebody doing that, okay, then I'll do that. A lot of people don't want to be the first.
Yeah.
But I don't mind. I don't mind. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important that the fact that, and I want to get the, make sure that the, I've been blessed to make sure that the physicians and researchers and things, that we're talking apples to apples. So if we don't understand something, then I can be the interpreter.
Thank you. This is so important. So important. And also thank you for being a part of our community advisory board.
Oh, it's a blessing. It's a blessing.
You joined the fellow Michigans in our group. Which is not like purposefully trying to find Michigans, but we're just so honored to have you and all of your incredible contributions to the CAB. And we cannot wait to keep doing more work with you as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. I told my wife more than once, man, blessed to be with the Oklahoma group, you know.
Thank you. What's so honor to have you. Because that we know you have such a full plate and all the things you do. So thank you for making our CAB what it is. This has been all of my questions. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for all the work you do. Thank you for just your heart as well. Despite all life has thrown at you, your compassion still shines through. And I also love how you remind us that adversity doesn't need to define us. It's how we respond to it, right?
Yes.
And faith can hold us even when the ground beneath us, you know, shifts. And
absolutely.
Then kindness, you know, when we extend it outwards, even while we're hurting, is both a radical and beautiful act. And on this Father's Day celebration you're doing, I pray that you keep finding your own purpose in everything you do. And thank you for just adding to the conversation of why our men are important, and that we cannot talk about lifespan and health span without talking about the importance of checking our numbers and, you know, going for health checkups, and even acknowledging that while this, you know, they call me fear and sometimes shame, we can still do it afraid, because at the end of the day, the family we care about, they want us to be here, you know,
whole-bodied.
And then we can also live lives as strong men and also be soft as well. And softness is not a weakness, right?
No, absolutely.
So, and thank you so much, Mr. Mark. It was really nice having you on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. It was a blessing. Very good.
And shout out to my team, the Mossable Podcast team, and then the More Labs. This is like the first time my research, well, one of the few times my research and my podcast kind of like intertwined, and I had my assistants on both ends trying to make the coordination, put the questions together. So shout out to all the members of the team, Parisa, Kumar, Bimbola, Great, and Ifeoluwa. Thank you all.
Great job.
Great job. Enjoy your weekend, Dan. Thank you so much.
You as well. Right. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.